Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. After the February 2012 Chardon, Ohio school shooting, which killed three students and injured three others, the United Way of Greater Cleveland established the Chardon Healing Fund and raised $952,000 for it. So far, a total of $417,000 have been distributed to the six families of the victims, according to the United Way. The balance is what's at stake in a lawsuit filed in May by the families of three of the victims. A Geauga County judge in May placed an immediate order to freeze the money in the fund pending the outcome of the case. The question of how charitable contributions are spent in the wake of sudden tragedy is an ongoing issue in Ohio and across the country. Coming up later, we'll hear from a writer for Mother Jones who looked at similar charity issues in the Columbine, Aurora, and Virginia Tech mass shootings. Joining us now by phone from Cleveland is Todd McKinney. He's the attorney representing the families in the Chardon charity lawsuit. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be on your show. I was a state legislator for a short time, and I always enjoyed listening to the issues we were voting on being discussed on your program as I was driving out of Columbus.
All right. We have a long lifespan on the air there. Thanks for listening. Also with us by phone from Cleveland is Bill Kitson. He's the president and CEO of the United Way of Greater Cleveland, which has been named in the suit, along with the United Way of Geauga County and the Geauga County Board of Mental Health and Recovery Services. Thanks for joining us, Bill Kitson.
Glad to be here this morning.
Todd McKinney, according to the lawsuit, the plaintiffs have each received less than $150,000 of that larger $952,000 fund. What portion of the charity did the families you represent believe was their entitlement in the first place?
Well, what they were told by the United Way on several occasions was, this is your money. And when their sons' pictures were broadcast with fundraising appeals from all the community groups that sought to raise money, I think they had a reasonable expectation that it was going to be more than, even by the United Way's numbers, 18%, which is what the families of the three deceased victims received.
Bill Kitson, the United Way of Greater Cleveland has said that it has handled all the donations properly and within the scope of the mission set forth. Can you give me a little quick timeline on how the mission was set forth and how your organization decided to distribute the funds?
Well, we were asked almost immediately to consider setting up a fund, and we were asked by companies in the Geauga County area and different foundations. And it was very, from the very beginning, a dual-purpose fund, not just for the victims, but also for the community to heal. And that's why it's called the Chardon Healing Fund, so that the entire community can heal. We quickly established a group of volunteers from the Geauga community who came together to do this work, and the Chardon Healing Fund board has been distributing those dollars ever since.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about those how charities pop up after mass tragedies. My guests right now, Todd McKinney, he's a lawyer who's representing three families in the Chardon charity lawsuit, and also Bill Kitson. He's the president and CEO of the United Way of Greater Cleveland, which is one of the organizations, the primary organization managing that fund. Todd McKinney, what Bill Kitson just described has pretty much been out there since the beginning. I'm wondering and trying to understand what the families, how the families were notified in advance about what they would receive and how the money, given the name of the charity, was going to be used otherwise.
I'll pick up right where Bill was. It's true that at the very beginning, in the days following the tragedy, there were one or two businesses who wanted to make lead gifts, and they actually became the president of the board and picked the other officers who were going to be on the board. But with this dual purpose, what that means is that the monies are commingled from the very start. There's no way to discern who was giving toward the victims and who was giving toward the community. As it turned out, at the time we filed the lawsuit, the amount distributed to the victims was 42%, according to their numbers. And the amount that was set aside for the community then and committed for the community was 58%. We don't think this reflects a rational kind of distribution, and it is responsible for a lot of the litigation around the country where the victims are asking, why is the community needing these funds for years and years of healing when we received a letter from the United Way saying after 6 months we were cut off? We appealed that, and they said, okay, after 1 year, you're cut off. And it just doesn't seem reasonable or consistent with why people give to these funds.
Bill Kitson, when they were putting together this organization that would manage the fund, were there any quote unquote best practices out there that you were looking to? Because as we know, and we'll talk about later in the program, these kinds of issues have popped up almost every time there's been one of these kinds of charities in the wake of a tragedy like this.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things I'd say right up front is I would say differently that it's not cut off. Those families were never told they were cut off. Those families just stopped receiving automatic checks. And we've constantly, from the very beginning, said to the families, please let us know what your needs are and we'll meet your needs. And so we've been trying to meet their immediate needs all along. Now, our volunteers have acknowledged that, you know, those families might have a difficult time coming forward and raising their hand saying we have these needs. And, you know, if we could go back in time and do it differently, we'd probably approach them differently. But we continue today to be available to their needs. And if they identify needs, we'll be glad to help them with it.
You've said that with respect to all the families, you're not releasing the exact amounts that each family has received. So the distribution, I would imagine, was not equal, correct?
Yeah, it was based on their needs and based on what their family condition was. And one of the things we tend to forget in this conversation is about the three families whose kids were injured. One of them is paralyzed and will have needs for the rest of his life. And so that's where a lot of this money ended up. It mm-hmm. ended up helping Nick and his family.
And the other injuries were serious as well?
Well, they weren't as serious as Nick's, mm-hmm. but it did end up being six families that were impacted by this as victims, as opposed to just the three that came forward.
So why not disclose the amounts that each family received? If we already know, and you've said Nick's family got the most because he has the most serious problems going forward for the rest of his life.
You know, we've just made it from the very beginning that we weren't going to be distributing those dollars. I mean, at some point through this legal process, that information will absolutely have to come out. But we're trying to help those families by not sharing their needs and their financial situations with the world.
Todd McKinney, do your clients want to receive all the money from the funds?
You know, Ann, what our clients want is a recognition that the fund was flawed in its formation, in the way that they that they commingled these monies from the start. And, you know, I would ask and could seek to settle this case right now by having everyone agree to pay the money into court, let the probate judge in Geauga County decide how much does the community need, how much do these victims need going forward, and end what is very painful litigation for the families of the three victims who died. They have been told, these families, the three victims, the reason why you're not receiving as much from this fund is because you don't have the same needs because your children died. Those kinds of painful statements, the plain dealer acknowledged that the fund was flawed in its inception when they talked to their experts. If we agree on that, or if there's some evidence of that, let's let the judge decide it. You know, the families of the three victims who died will abide by that. United Way can't say that it's harm because, you know, there's a fair and partial party deciding how the money's distributed. And we can all get on with this. And I'm still asking why that isn't possible. In terms of the community, one additional thing is, in the last state budget just passed, $1.2 million was allocated to the Chardon community for behavioral health and for the schools. $1.2 million over 2 years. There is more than enough money for the community, but we're willing to let the judge make that decision. How much will the community need going forward of the remaining about $370,000 that remains in the fund? We're just asking for a place to appeal to say, you know, we have not received as much as we should have. The fund hasn't been fair toward us, and we're just asking somebody, you make another decision, we'll live with whatever it is.
Bill Kitson of United Way of Greater Cleveland, how do you figure when it comes to community needs after an event like this? What sort of equation are you using to figure the community need?
Well, the volunteers of the Chardon Healing Fund reached out to folks who lived through this in Columbine, and they reached out to folks who lived through this at Virginia Tech. And, in fact, some Virginia Tech folks came up to Chardon to work with families and people at the school. And so they've been trying to get best practices aligned to make sure that they're doing the right things for the community. It was their intention all along to have a 50-50 split of this. That's still what's in their mind right now. Now, Todd's saying that he'd end this today if we all turn everything over to the judge to let him do it. That's a new request of us. It's not something we've heard in mediation from him previously, so I suppose we'd have to go back and ask our Chardon Healing Fund volunteers what they think about that.
And you said earlier, I think, Bill Kitson, that if family members, survivors needed more, they could come forward and ask for it?
Absolutely. We've said that from the very beginning, and we've tried to have conversations with families about this.
And Todd McKinney, that's a troublesome because people don't necessarily want to have to explain or ask for it or just describe what their troubles are.
Very painful, and the victims of the families of those who've died have been told you don't have the same needs as other people. And so we don't feel like we're getting fair consideration from the fund. This is the first time I've ever heard that the fund from its beginning wanted to make a 50-50 split. Never published. It's news to me. They did have representatives from Virginia Tech come to Chardon, and one of them has contacted us and told, and he's become an expert on these national funds, and he said he told the volunteers for the fund on two separate occasions, do not set up the fund this way where you mix the monies, you're going to get exactly the result that we've got today. Our feeling is the fund didn't want to listen to those kind of comments because they were focused on setting aside money for the community. That's where their large donors were indicating they wanted the money to go, even though they appealed to hundreds in the community to donate almost $1 million. That's how we're approaching it.
Bill Kitson, can you tell me where, from where you sit, where the lawsuit is at this point?
We're in mediation right now. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to talk back and forth to see if there's something that can be worked out. The judge has given us until the end of the month to try to figure that out. Otherwise, the lawsuit will proceed.
Okay. And as far as the legislative appropriation, does that have any impact on how you manage the fund, Bill Kitson?
Well, the Chardon volunteers just learned about it at the same time Todd and others learned about this.
Very recently.
It's not money that's coming to the Chardon Healing Fund, mm-hmm. so we're not in charge of how that gets distributed. Mm-hmm. We think it's a great, noble effort to make sure that communities are prepared for crises like this, and we can have an evidence-based model that comes from this so that if this ever happens somewhere else, we can turn and say, this is how you go about doing it. Mm-hmm. But really, when we take a look at the needs of the community, this is just yet another opportunity for the community to get help, but it certainly doesn't mean that the community's now healed. That's going to take decades.
All right. Well, I thank you so much, Bill Kitson, for joining us today to talk about it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Bill Kitson, he's president and CEO of the United Way of Greater Cleveland. Todd McKinney, you as well. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Todd McKinney, he's a lawyer at Leiby, Hanna & Rasnick and represents the families in the Chardon Charity lawsuit. Lawsuit is aimed at the United Way of Greater Cleveland, among other organizations. Stay with us. We're going to turn our sights to a journalist who's been covering these issues and looked back in time at how other charities that have popped up in the wake of tragedy have been managed. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When sympathy leads to charity, especially in the cases of such tragedies as the Chardon shooting and the Boston Marathon bombing, often the generous give and assume the best. We talked earlier about the lawsuit filed against the United Way of Greater Cleveland and others after less than half of the $952,000 donated would go to the families of the victims. A similar scenario has played out in Newton, Connecticut, after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary claimed the lives of 20 children and 6 adults. We'll hear more about that later on in the show. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is Mother Jones reporter Dana Leibelson. Dana was inspired by the Sandy Hook charity conflict to look at what has happened to charitable donations related to other high-profile tragedies. Her report was published in April. You can check it out on a link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for joining us today, Dana.
Thanks for having me.
You looked at the charity funds for the shootings at Columbine High School in 1999, Virginia Tech in 2007, and a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado in 2012. What were you looking at? What were you looking for?
Well, I think we see in the wake of these kinds of tragedies two different kinds of charities spring up. We see charities that have designated funds, which is when a charity specifically raises money for a purpose such as a memorial or a scholarship. And then we see these big pool funds, which is where the majority of the money goes. And what I did in this case is I looked at the big pool fund for each one of these shootings, which usually was several million dollars. And the reason I wanted to do this is you hear that a lot of money doesn't go to victims after these kinds of tragedies, and I wanted to find out if that was actually the case. And what I determined is, on one hand, we don't see these charities taking, you know, a big profit from the money that they get. But on the other hand, we see, you know, we just see a lot of this money not actually going to victims. We see it going to nonprofits. We see it going to the community. And in a lot of cases, this isn't actually what the victims want.
How are these organizations, I, for lack of a better phrase, I'm calling them sort of pop-up charities.
Yeah, I think that's really appropriate.
How are they managed? In Chardon, it was an all-volunteer group, but certain, I guess, people who planted the seed money for the charity ended up being able to decide who all the volunteers were going to be on the board. How are they usually managed? Are they usually volunteer? Who gets to pick who gets to be on the boards?
Well, I think we often see established charities with good ratings, like, say, United Way, behind these kinds of projects. But then the community wants input, and that's where you start seeing volunteers who are different members of the community, whether it's people affected by the tragedy or, you know, local law enforcement. But, you know, what was really surprising to me is that you don't often see these big pools of funds deciding where the money's going to go before they start receiving it. And that was just really shocking to me, because you have these organizations that are suddenly sitting on $5 million and they haven't decided, you know, when they're going to distribute it and how it's going to be distributed. And I think what you see across the board is it takes much longer than you'd expect for the funds to actually reach the victims.
Why is that? Why does it take so long to distribute funds to victims or their families?
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that they don't exactly know where they want the money to go. I mean, sometimes you want this to go back into the community. Sometimes you see it going to, say, mental health organizations or nonprofits like that. So, you know, I think if you had something like a federal fund where the stated mission is that all the money would go to the victims, I think it would happen much faster.
Typically, are these kinds of charity funds setting aside a substantial amount for the communities for counseling and long-term issues? We heard in the last segment that these issues in the community are expected to continue for a decade.
Right. I think it kind of depends on the tragedy. For example, in Columbine, that actually saw the least amount of money go directly to victims. Of the money raised, about $2.6 went to victims and their families. About $1 went to mental health care. And then roughly $500,000 went to services in the Columbine community, which wasn't really specified. And I think, you know, we tend to see most of the money going to victims, but sometimes it actually takes the victims speaking out for them to see money. I think a good example of that is the Aurora shooting. The Community First Foundation collected about $5.8 million in funds, and they initially only distributed about $5,000 to each family. And it wasn't until the families came out and sort of expressed outrage about this that the remaining funds were distributed, and that didn't happen for months.
Typically, we understand that when someone's been seriously hurt in one of these incidents, particularly in the Chardon school, and I'm sure there's examples in most of these kinds of tragedies, someone's paralyzed for life, they have long-term rehabilitation ahead of them, they can't work anymore, all kinds of things. Those are long-term expenses. Are the expectations that funds like that will go to help those people first?
I think what I discovered after speaking to hospitals is the cost to mass shooting victims can be really astronomical. I mean, the cost of an ER bed alone per day is $5,000. If you have health insurance, you know, the cost per victim can be under $1,000, but many victims don't have it. And if you have a case where someone is paralyzed, those costs can skyrocket up to, you know, past $100,000, up to $1 million. And I think when I actually looked at how much money was awarded from each of these funds, it still wasn't anything close to really, you know, covering these costs. In Virginia Tech and Columbine, the most commonly awarded amount was about $10,000. And payment amounts were distributed based on number of nights spent in the hospital. And that's another whole issue, is figuring out how to distribute money based on injuries, because that's obviously really sort of a sensitive and terrible thing to have to think about. And after Aurora, victims who spent fewer than 7 days in the hospital received $35,000. But based on the hospitals I spoke with, that's still not really enough money to cover some of their medical costs.
And when people are giving money to these funds, it just starts flying in willy-nilly almost. What do we know about what most people think their money's going to be spent on?
Well, I mean, I think people tend to donate after sort of watching these awful images on TV, and they expect that the money will go straight to victims. I think in other cases where people, you know, let's say at Virginia Tech, people wanted money to go to a scholarship fund. There was a designated fund where people could donate to that. But when you have these big funds where there's no mission stated, I think they sort of expect that the money will go straight to victims, and that's not always the case. On the other hand, though, I don't think that any experts would argue against donating to charities. You're definitely guaranteed sort of a greater transparency and accountability than if you give directly to someone, say, over the internet. I think you see some of those pop-up sites, and those definitely are very eligible for fraud. But I think, you know, one of the organizations I talked to is called Charity Navigator, and that's a good website where they evaluate about 50% of the donations in the United States and rate the different charities, sort of based on their financial health and also their transparency and accountability. So that's definitely a good place to start if you want to see whether or not the charity you're donating to is legitimate.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dana Libelson. She's a reporter at Mother Jones. She investigated three different charities, the circumstances of the charities that popped up in the wake of three different tragedies. The 1999 Columbine High School shooting, the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007, and then Sandy Hook in 2012. Well, was Sandy Hook part of that? No.
Yes, it was. Okay. And I looked at Aurora as well.
Okay, Aurora as well. Okay. The spokesperson, the CEO of the United Way of Greater Cleveland said earlier that they haven't, with respect to all the families, they were not releasing the exact amounts that each family received out of respect for the families that maybe had more. I guess it was a sensitivity issue. Is that pretty common when you talk about transparency? Are you talking about that kind of transparency?
That's actually very uncommon. I mean, I looked at Virginia Tech, Aurora, and Columbine, and in each of those cases, the charities produced full transparency reports on how much money each victim's family received based on the extent of their injuries. So as far as I know, Sandy Hook is the first case where they haven't done that.
There have been conflicts, though, at these other charities. Do you look at one as, or is there one that's considered more successful than others in managing the money and keeping everybody satisfied with how they've done it?
I think Virginia Tech handled it very effectively, which obviously it was a different case because instead of dealing with, you know, a city, we had a education institution. For them, they received about $10 million in funds, and of that, $8.5 million went directly to victims and their families, and the other $1.5 million went to, you know, designated scholarship accounts. So, you know, I think that that was a case where the money was handled very efficiently and was and went where it was supposed to. I think, like I mentioned before, sort of the most disorganized case was what happened at Columbine. And that, I think, was just, it wasn't because of any ill will. It was because people just had different, they weren't quite sure where they wanted the money to go in order to prevent something like this from happening again. And that's why we saw a lot of money going to different nonprofits and mental health and violence prevention, as well as to victims and their families.
I wondered if you had looked at how effective that kind of spending is. It was mentioned in the last segment that this issue is expected to be a community kind of recovery issue for as long as a decade.
Right. You know, I haven't actually looked at how the different nonprofits ended up spending those funds, because my goal was just to figure out, you know, if the money that was supposed to go to victims actually went to victims. So that's something that I definitely think further study would be good on.
You reported that the Aurora Fund was the most successful in getting money directly to the victims and the fastest.
I would say Virginia Tech.
Actually,
yeah, because the university obviously was in a very good position to make decisions quickly with this.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Charity Navigator. In your article, you spoke with Sandra Minuiti.
Yes,
it's a watchdog group that evaluates more than 6,500 charities throughout the country. She said the organizations that provide more transparency and accountability than giving to specific. She said that organizations provide more transparency and accountability than giving to specific individuals. What did she mean by that?
I mean, I think you see online people set up sites to fundraise for, you know, say their own children, and while that looks like a great way to get money directly to victims, sometimes it's very easy for these sites to be fraudulent. So you know, I think it is better to find a charity, but at the same time, these charities aren't perfect. And I think something we see with mass shootings is that, you know, a charity that may normally have a 4-star rating and be very transparent still isn't necessarily equipped to deal with the very particular things that this kind of tragedy demands. And they're not really equipped to do this very quickly. So, you know, I think that brings us back to the idea of having some sort of federal fund, which I think has been brought up repeatedly with Sandy Hook.
I haven't asked our listeners, but if anybody has a question or comment, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You wrote in the piece about the Newton, Connecticut families wanting to establish a national fund for future tragedies with protocols that would distribute 100% of money raised to the victims and their families. Can you tell us a little bit about what they're talking about there?
Sure. I think the families of Newtown and the community, I think, has sort of seen the debate and the problems that have come with these big charity funds in past mass shootings. And I think as a result of that, they've raised this idea of creating a compassion fund. And under this proposal, it would be a federal fund, and 100% of the money donated after the tragedies would be sent directly to victims. So I think the idea behind this is to sort of, you know, cut out whatever profit that the charities may be making. And I just want to set the record straight that the charities don't take, like, a cut from this money usually. Mm-hmm. But I think what it would do is it would definitely expedite how fast these funds go to victims. And it would also, you know, make sure that the money that's supposed to go to victims goes to victims and doesn't go to other charity organizations.
According to the New York Times, that agreement is in the works, and it's known as the National Compassion Fund. So it's a matter of efficiency and getting the money to people right away. That's very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think we haven't seen that happen really with the community funds in the past.
A spokesman for the Connecticut Attorney General was quoted in your article saying that this sort of information, you know, being as transparent as possible is desirable, even though typically it isn't done that way. Once again, why is it so important that everybody know where every dime went?
I mean, otherwise, I think we end up seeing money going to nonprofits that perhaps the people who donated didn't intend their money to go to.
Okay.
So I think, you know, that's the biggest one.
What about designating money? Designated funds, that has proved a problem in the Newton, Connecticut case.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Newtown, Connecticut, we've seen probably about 70 different funds set up, you know, in addition or perhaps including the central fund. And, you know, I don't think someone like Charity Navigator, there's no issue with having different designated funds. Sometimes people do want their money to go to a cause that's not, you know, necessarily directly supporting victims. It could be something about prevention. But I think the biggest thing is the transparency around knowing exactly where the money's going. And some of these designated funds are actually better at providing that than sort of the big pool of money.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for my guest, Dana Leibelson. She's a reporter at Mother Jones. We are going to continue the conversation and hopefully bring in the State Commissioner of Consumer Protection in Connecticut, William Rubenstein, in the next segment. So if you want to stay with us, we appreciate it. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the generosity of strangers in the wake of mass tragedy translates when it comes to distributing the charitable donations. Should the victims and their families, the larger community, or both benefit? In March, Connecticut's Attorney General asked charities related to the Sandy Hook tragedy, at least 69 at that time, to disclose how they were spending the money. Watchdog groups applauded the effort, but earlier this month, some family members of the 26 victims were still questioning the investigation and how the foundation, now overseeing an $11.4 million fund, was operating. According to the Hartford Courant newspaper, joining us now from Connecticut is the State Commissioner of Consumer Protection, William Rubenstein. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Still with us is Mother Jones reporter Dana Leibelson. You can check out her article on this topic at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Commissioner Rubenstein, what was going on in April that prompted the Attorney General in your office to request the disclosure by the Sandy Hook-related charities?
Well, you know, after the tragic shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School, there was enormous outpouring of generosity by people all over the country, in fact, all over the world. Lots of money started pouring in that was unsolicited to a variety of different sources who were collecting money ultimately to have something to do with easing the pain that occurred on that day. We noticed immediately that there were lots of new organizations that were springing up to collect this money. The money was going to several disparate places. Some money that was being collected was significant, and we thought that transparency was important so that the public knew, the donating public knew, who was collecting money, what they were collecting for, how much did they collect, and what are they doing with the money. So we thought that the best way to do that was to figure out who all was out there collecting money. We identified actually now over 70 different entities collecting money, and we asked them to account for themselves.
CharityNet, well, what did you find when you looked at those accountings? Some reports said that you only got to about 3% of them. What did you get to?
Well, we've actually now gotten responses from all but one of the entities that we contacted, so it's over 70 of them.
Okay.
The one that has not responded yet has told us that they will be responding, so we're confident that that will happen. We found that in excess of $21 million was collected. It was collected by a wide variety of organizations and with different purposes. The largest single fund was collected by the United Way of Western Connecticut, which collected around $11.4 million.
What do you make of how the money, particularly in the smaller charities, what do you make of how the money was distributed? Did they know what they were doing?
Well, the money has not all been distributed. In fact, most of the money has not yet been distributed.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find is that in the aftermath of these kinds of tragedies, people want to do something, and they want to do something to help. And some people can do something to help by giving money, and they feel compelled to do that. And other people find a way to help by collecting money. And they often don't know what they're getting into when they do it. These organizations that's kind of spring up as a result of the tragedy, they're trying to do a good thing, but they don't understand the enormous fiduciary responsibility they've taken on. We've done an enormous amount of outreach to a lot of these entities to make sure that they started to put in place those those structural organizations that they can in order to account for the money, where it came from, be able to have protocols in place for distribution, for accounting for the money. We've been working with a lot of these groups to make sure they have those in place. But there are many, many of these entities that collected that really were not equipped for what is to come in terms of appropriate distribution.
Dana Leibelson, in your reporting, you said that the Virginia Tech was the exception because they were already operating through this larger entity, which was the university. In Aurora and in Columbine, did a bunch of pop-up charities, that sort of thing happen in those places?
Yeah, I think that's very common. And even for me, it was hard for me to track all of those other kinds of individual charities, which is why I focused on the one big charity that collected the majority of the funds in each of the cases. So, you know, I think it's great that we have the Office of the Attorney General looking at those individual funds because I think they're also prone to fraud.
We have an email from Melanie. She asks, how about tax issues? Do donors expect a write-off? It seems that most of the pop-up charities do not have a nonprofit status. No time for that. William Rubenstein, did you find that to be the case, that they just were not prepared legally?
Yeah, you know, unless it takes a long time to get a 501c designation. And so unless you're a pre-existing charity, you're not going to have that 501c designation. So these pop-ups, if they're just starting out, are not going to be tax deductible, you know, and what we try to get these entities to do is to be very clear with their donors as to whether or not there's a tax deduction or not. We don't want donors to be misled. But, you know, in these kinds of tragedies, at least in the immediate aftermath, mm-hmm. the tax deduction is the last thing on people's minds. Mm-hmm. Really what's on their mind is this money going to go to help the thing that I want to help? And you know, that's the harder issue for people is not whether it's tax deductible. The harder issue is knowing who's collecting the money. Are they trustworthy, and are they equipped to give the money for the purpose I intended it?
I'm talking with William Rubenstein. He's a state commissioner of consumer protection in Connecticut, and also Dana Leibelson, a reporter at Mother Jones, about the pop-up charities that come about after large tragic events like the Boston Marathon bombing and the Sandy Hook school shooting. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Charity Navigator CEO Ken Berger applauded your efforts, Commissioner, in requesting those documents, but the Hartford Courant earlier in July wrote that some of the families still are dissatisfied with the distribution of the funds. Are you aware of their complaints and what they're concerned about?
Well, I mean, we're aware of the complaints with regard to the large fund that's out there. They're continuing to have dialogues with the fund holders. You know, our purpose in doing the survey that we did was to shine a light on this whole process so that we had some transparency. You know, getting the original survey gave us a snapshot in time. It gave us at least a baseline for what money was collected, what its intended purpose was, and how much funds are left to be distributed. We will do a follow-up survey over the next few weeks to see how well all these entities are doing in fulfilling their promise. You know, that's a different project than the project of ultimately overseeing for enforcement purposes whether or not these entities are using the money for the purpose that the donors gave it. You know, right now we're still trying to get some transparency on what the plan is for distribution, and then we'll evaluate it from there. I do want to say though that, mm-hmm. that these entities, you know, in the wake of these tragedies, there are scam artists out there who are right. trying to clip money. The entities we're talking about, by and large, are not scam artists. They are folks who are looking to do good. They're people of good faith, largely. and sometimes get caught up, take a bigger bite than they know how to chew or swallow. And we think, by and large, the amount of money that was scammed in Sandy Hook is minuscule compared to the amount of money that at least found its way to hands that were held out in good faith.
I was going to say I was impressed when you said that all but one had yet to, and that they were planning on responding to your request. That's got to make you feel good there aren't, unless there's something out there that you don't know about.
You know, within a day after the tragedy, we were out there with a very aggressive consumer message about how to give and how to give safely. We didn't get to everybody, and everybody is not a smart donor all the time. But we think getting that message out immediately would really help people to try to understand, at least do they know the people they're giving the money to.
Have you fielded any complaints or concerns by people who have donated money, worried about where their money went and what's being done with it?
You know, we haven't heard from donors who are concerned. We know what we don't want to do is to dampen the generosity of people by fostering some notion that people never know what happens to the money. So we think transparency is not only helpful in this circumstance, but it actually allows people to feel more comfortable and confident in their giving after the next tragedy.
Dana Leibelson and I were talking earlier about some Newton, Connecticut families wanting to establish that national fund, the National Compassion Fund. What do you make of that, and how do you think it would help?
You know, having a safe fund where donors know how it's going to be distributed, who's collecting the money, and the purpose for which it's going to be distributed in advance is always a good thing. Connecticut just established a Connecticut Care Fund by legislation that's going to allow itself to spring up in the wake of a tragedy or a disaster to collect money with an appointed board of directors and an appointed set of purposes. You know, they did a very good job, I think, in Boston after the Boston Marathon shooting to direct people to a single fund that was at least being monitored very carefully. I think having a pre-designated fund where people can feel comfortable and confident that their money is going to go to the purpose intended is a good idea.
Do you have any sense about there's the issue of what money goes to the victims or the victims' families and what money goes to the community? Does anybody have a good sense about what the effectiveness is of the money going to communities for mental health purposes? I'm sure people wanted to designate money for the school. I'm not sure, but I would imagine there were people who just wanted to give money to the school.
Well, people want to give money to the school did so. In fact, a lot of money came in directly to PTAs or school-related organizations. What we in the charity business care about is the money going to be used for the purpose for which it was given? That is, what did the donors want to be done with this money? And sometimes it's hard to tell when it's chaotic. I know Ken Feinberg, who was administrator in several of these funds, Virginia Tech and Aurora and up in Boston. In my discussions with him, he feels very confident that the overwhelming purpose for which people give money after these tragedies is for victim compensation as opposed to ongoing programs. That seems right. Most people, disasters are different, but these tragedies where the real harm is personal injury and death, loss of limb, it seems sensible that what people are trying to do is ease the pain of the victim.
It's kind of strange to talk about creating national funds for the next mass murder.
Yeah, but to not believe that there will be a next mass murder is really to blink at reality. Unfortunately and sadly, we don't know where it's going to come, but we know that over time there will be one.
Dana Leibelson, can we talk more about CharityNavigator.org's work to help organizations in these situations? Charity Navigator doesn't just work as a watchdog. It also helps organizations?
I'm not as familiar with that. I think as someone who wants to donate, the best way you can use Charity Navigator as a resource is to just go online or give them a call and figure out, you know, if the charity you're donating to has a good evaluation from them.
Uh-huh. How do they manage to follow that many organizations? What's their process?
You know, I think they do a lot of outreach with the organizations. They track their funding. They do audits, which I think is something that's really important and should be done even more with some of these charities that pop up in the wake of mass shootings.
And William Rubenstein, is there any sort of acceptable equation that's at work when it comes to divvying up the money between victims who are seriously injured and the families of victims who were killed?
You know, from our perspective, the equation for us is, what did the donors intend to happen to the money? And you can tell that donor intent sometimes by the nature of how the money was solicited, what it was promised to go for. Sometimes you can tell that from donors specifically saying what they wanted the money to go to, or from the circumstance. And you know, it's a difficult task to do, where money has come in unsolicited from a lot of different sources, some of which were delineated as to what its purpose, and others weren't. So it's not an easy task. We hope the entities who have the fiduciary responsibility at least have a good reason behind the way in which they're making those allocations.
And Dana Leibelson, to what extent has technology contributed to this kind of giving? Maybe not the massiveness of it, but the numbers of organizations that pop up?
Well, I think it's never been easier to start a charity organization and get your message out through the internet. And I think that's why this kind of auditing and transparency is so important, because, you know, the organizations you see online, you don't know sort of if their intentions are true.
Okay.
You know, giving after these events is wildly chaotic, both from the donor's perspective and from the charity's perspective. Money comes in ways in which it never came in before. It comes in envelopes. It comes in with addresses to banks and schools and organizations, not necessarily delineating even what it's for. It's a way in which even organized charities are not used to dealing with receiving money.
Right. Well, I want to thank you, William Rubenstein, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
William Rubenstein, he's the State Commissioner of Consumer Protection for the state of Connecticut. And Dana Leibelson, thanks as well to you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dana Leibelson, she's a reporter at Mother Jones. You can check out her article on this topic on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And you can discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher at wosu.org/allsides. From our website, you can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 to noon. You can also explore our archive, which includes audio, video, and podcasts of every show. That's at wosu.org/allsides. I hope by now that you have checked out our app for your tablet or your smartphone. You can go to wosu.org, and there'll be a link there for you to do that. I want to give special thanks to Shannon Clary for producing this show. I also want to give thanks to the entire All Sides staff: producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Shannon Clary, Leticia Wiggins, and Emmanuel Joshi, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, Ann, on Twitter too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener supported, WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.